And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. And I'm now here with Jeff Deist. And some of you will know him from Twitter and elsewhere. Jeff, could you introduce... This is another debut, incidentally, another first-timer. So, Jeff, could you introduce yourself to the audience?
Certainly. I appreciate the invitation. Now, I see you have me listed very broadly as American economist and commentator.
Yes, so I thought that was safe.
We have that big pregnant American adjective at the start. I wouldn't call myself an economist. I'm certainly well-versed in the Austrian school, no doubt. I spent 10 years at the Mises Institute here in the United States running that. I had worked for Congressman Ron Paul previously. Most of my career, I've been a lawyer in the mergers and acquisitions space, doing deal work. I work for a company now called Monetary Metals, and though it's not mergers and acquisitions per se, we do deals. We finance mining projects. We finance jewelry chains in India and Turkey and UAE and places like that. So I'm still in that world, and that's an interesting world unto itself. But primarily, I'm a cranky sort of dissident right-wing guy on Twitter. I come out of libertarian and Austrian economic circles, but have definitely moved in, I guess I would call it a more pragmatic or direction, less ideological direction. I'm not much interested in ideology. I'm not much interested in people using principle, so-called, as a mask for cowardice, for not doing things in the real world. And that's why I very much enjoyed your last guest, Woodlander. I was thinking to myself, I'm the anti-Woodlander, just in terms of his appearance. And he looks like a big, rugged, outdoor kind of guy, and he's very attached to the land, and I'm suburbaner. Like it or not, I'm very much a member of the laptop class, I think I must admit. So the one similarity is that I have a Labrador that is twin to his, with one important distinction. As you'll know, the English Labradors have a shorter snout. The American bred ones tend to have a little longer nose to them. But other than that, they could be brothers. So I was pleased to see that. And I enjoyed listening to him. And you know, the back to the land stuff and just the whole idea of connection to the land, a connection to a place, any sense of place is something it's almost entirely lost in the United States, more so than in Europe. I have friends and family in Europe, and they tell me that, you know, people don't just pick up and move nearly as much. There's obviously language barriers for one. They also don't just pick up and sell a family home as quickly and easily as we do in the United States. In the United States, you might be talking to a friend and say, oh my gosh, you know, we're going to move to Dallas. My husband, my wife got a new job. Very, very common. And oh, we got to put our house on the market and this and that. I mean, it just happens all the time. And so that's, I think, one of the big problems with America. And this is where libertarians really, really screw the pooch badly, is assigning zero value to any of this, or assigning zero market to humans wanting any sort of continuity or tradition in life. You know, that's not a widget that can't be sold. So we sort of don't think about it in economics. And one of the big failings of economics is that it doesn't want to play culture. So you put all this in a blender, and this is kind of how I came out in middle age in my particular perspective.
That's interesting. I think that I often hear this from Americans, that they've lived in like six or seven different states, and they've moved around. They went to college here, then they had a job at this other state, and they grew up in this other state, and they were born in another state, and now they're living in another state. That does seem to happen a lot. In Europe, as you say, the language barrier kind of puts a limit on that, although everyone speaks English nowadays. But still, I think people are probably more attached. I think that's sort of inevitable. There's more to be attached to. There's a longer history. I mean, your people might have been Germans, even if they didn't call themselves Germans. They might have lived there in that place for 1,000 years or 2,000 years or even longer. So that there's more to hold on to. And I don't say that. I don't want to make this into America versus Europe thing, because obviously everyone is dealing with what they were born into. But I do think that's a contrast with the new and old worlds. So would you say that this is something that, I mean, it's obviously something that you have respect for, the people being attached to the land. But is it something that doesn't come naturally to you? And don't worry about it saying yes to that. I'm not going to jump down.
I think it does not come naturally to me. I think I am a natural American, and while I feel very much a connection to our European brothers and sisters, and I want that connection to be maintained, and I don't like these spitballs going back and forth. I'm definitely culturally an American. I have moved a lot, and you know, I think that affects your outlook. And the idea of moving for a better job, which normally means a higher income, is very, very common here. And unfortunately, there's another reason for moving, and that's because you lose your job and you have to. That happens in America quite a bit as well. So there's a good and a bad to that. I do think that this is broadly speaking, that it's a little easier to fire people in America, and thus it's a little easier to become hired in America. I do think the European employment laws are a little stricter. Certainly, the European landlord-tenant laws are quite a bit stricter. People have greater tenant protections, I think, pretty much across the EU. So even though a lot of people rent, for example, in Germany and Switzerland, you know, a higher percentage of people rent than in the US, you can't just boot out an 85-year-old woman from her flat when the lease is up because you want to raise the rent 25%, you know. And so it's there's a lot of transient thinking in the United States, and I think that goes beyond just one's personal life. I think it flows into the business world as well. We have more of a next quarter bottom line mindset here. People watch markets almost obsessively. People watch what the Fed does almost obsessively in interest rates, especially if you happen to be in investment banking or mortgage banking or the construction trades, that sort of thing. So, you know, these differences remain. But I think what we share with Europe now is a recognition that elites have failed us across the West, that the political status quo is not worth conserving, and that there's nothing wrong with Europe or America. There's nothing bad about our history, and that we shouldn't apologize for the West and its achievements. We shouldn't apologize for Western Christendom, and that, a purely material outlook doesn't necessarily yield a lot of human happiness. Clearly richer in the material sense than our grandparents were. Are we any happier? I would argue we're probably not.
And I think what I would ask you is, to what extent, see, I don't have a lot of people on from the world of economics, and you said you're not an economist, but you are involved in business and mergers, acquisitions,
and most economists aren't economists either. So
yeah,
I'm right there with as good as them.
Right. Okay. And so I don't have a lot of people on from that world, which is a shame, because I don't think I would be any good in that world, but I don't have the right brain for it. But I am interested in it and sort of impressed by it in the way that one is impressed by, well, anything that one is not good at. I'm not good at maths, so I'm always impressed by people who are. But also, we still live in a world in which these things matter, and we probably always will. And so it's salient. You know, I think it's probably good for people to know about property, buying and selling. Even if this current order collapses, as some people predict, we will still need those skills. We'll still need the knowledge of how to deal with this. What's the legal route? And again, in business, you know, businesses will still be there. So all of this is still relevant, perhaps more now than ever. I think a lot of people they grow up maybe working class, lower middle class, and they assume that this stuff they'll never need to know about this because they will just do a job, and they'll do what is required of them, and they'll be rewarded for that with a pension and a steady salary and maybe a few perks, and that's that. But I think you come from a world in which people think more flexibly than that, and not so much about doing a job as enabling and creating, shaping the environment in which people do jobs. Now, my point that I'm getting to is, do you agree with me that it would be advantageous for more people to know about this kind of thing so that they had more freedom of action and could shape their lives with more options?
Well, in a sense, we want to understand at least how they're pulling the wool over us, right? We want to understand markets and the business world and the regulatory world, which I would consider treasury, fiscal, governance, and then central banks. So there's a lot to all of this. But I think if you study it, at least from the Austrian perspective, your tendency will be to come to kind of a populist perspective on this, that they're screwing us over. And that's true. How and why is complicated, but they are screwing us over. There is a class of undeserving or unjust rich who manipulate the system and move money around, but don't really produce anything for society. Not only goods and services, but they don't really produce anything. And so I think it's important for average people to understand that. And I wouldn't want people to graduate from, let's say, public school or college, university, without understanding some basic economics, just like we would expect them to have literacy and numeracy when they graduate. So I do think that's true. What I've learned and what I've done in my career is sadly something that under 40s very much struggle with. I'm in my 50s. So, you know, people under 40, especially under 30, I think, the old route of, let's say, among other things, going to law school, let's say working in big four accounting firm settings where I worked for many years, that was wide open. That was available to them. Now, so many things that, let's say, boomers and Gen X took for granted, like go to college and try to get decent grades, and gee whiz, you can go become a teacher or a dentist or an accountant or a lawyer or a doctor, maybe, if you're smart, or even a scientist if you're smart. You can get a PhD. And if you do get a PhD, well, you'll probably almost certainly have a decent job. You know, these were all things that were starting to crumble a bit in my time, but have really crumbled for the millennials and Zoomers and whatever we call people, younger people today.
Alpha, Gen Alpha.
Yeah. So that's a really tough reality. And I think that goes to a lot of the populist resentment on the right, and correctly so.
This is a situation that a lot of people have talked about, that, and you know, it's a sort of new thing to talk in terms of generations. The boomers was always that was a category. Gen X, people talked about it. But with the Zoomers, this really seems to have stepped up, and people are talking in generational terms far more now than they did 15, 20 years ago. To my memory, maybe you would say differently, but that's certainly my memory. And I think it's relevant because of the fast pace of change in economic conditions. So what that means is that, as you've just said, the Zoomers will not have they're not operating in the same kind of environment at all that millennials did in their 20s. It's a completely different thing now. Radically different, and certainly radically different from what the boomers were contending with in their 20s. So I guess I'm wondering, to what extent, if you were advising someone who was, let's say, 22 now, what would you say to them in terms of bulletproofing themselves against the future financially?
Yes, a very good question, because a lot of those old line jobs appear to be coming to an end in one way or another, or they're at least not available to a lot of people. And so you can't just think in those linear ways, like, I'm going to go to college and get this degree, or I'm going to go to trade school, whatever it might be, and get this job, and then I'll have that job for a long time, and I'll work up, and hopefully my salary will go up, and I'll save some money and buy a house, and et cetera. It doesn't seem like that path is available to a lot of people now, or at least the perception is that it's not. And so that forces people to think more entrepreneurially. And let's be fair here. Most people aren't entrepreneurs. Most people are not really wired to get up every day and be on the hook for the profit and loss of a business. Most people are wired for a paycheck. I mean, that's just a fact. And if you talk to anyone who owns a company of any size, they can describe to you some very rough nights sleeping where they were worried about payroll or whatever they were worried about. And so this idea that everyone's just going to wake up and be an entrepreneur and they're going to have some Etsy shop start up some little company and have a side hustle and all this and that, it's really fatiguing to even talk about. That's not how most people are. And so you're either going to have a job where your skills are somewhat in demand, or what I suspect is coming is what we saw glimpses of during COVID, which is basically a massive universal basic income. I suspect that is coming with the technological changes and dislocations that I suspect are coming. So ironically, we thought even 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago, that some sort of hyper-technical specialization was the way to go. You need to be either this finance big brain who can manipulate numbers and go to Wall Street, and that's one way to get really rich, go work at Goldman Sachs and become a partner, or you need to head out to Silicon Valley. Again, forgive my American perspective here. You need to head out to Silicon Valley and get a job there, and you need to be working on platforms or coding or whatever it might be, and you're going to start work for some startup and get some stock, and then they're going to go public, and you're going to be a deca-millionaire by the time you're 30, right? I mean, this was the thinking. And that hyper-technical specialist mindset hasn't worked out for a lot of people more recently. I mean, Wall Street, when we really begin to look at algorithmic trading and the ways that investment decisions can be made, the way index funds work and that sort of thing, you start to wonder, you know, how many of those jobs were kind of smoke and mirrors, how many of those jobs were effectively subsidized by crazy monetary policy that made the cost of borrowing artificially cheap. You know, you start to wonder about that. And we don't have to wonder about Silicon Valley. We've seen the precipitous decline in the employment fortunes of recent computer science graduates. So my only advice to a younger person, and I have two kids that I worry about very much, my advice is feeble, but it's what I got. And that it would be two things, which is one, if you're scientifically or mechanically or mathematically minded, think about that old analog world, that corporeal world of meat space and stuff, because there really is a competency crisis and the boomers really are running what's left of that stuff, and they're retiring and dying off. So when I say stuff, when I say the analog world, I mean things like turbines. I mean things like waste treatment and water systems. I mean, things like electrical and power grids. I think things like roads and bridges and infrastructure. The physical stuff that we're still going to need, the calories, how the calories get to people. All of that infrastructure, especially in the United States, is aging rapidly. It's going to need somebody to work on it and fix it and build it. And if you can do that, even if you're a white guy, they might have to hire you, so to speak. So I do think that thinking about that analog world, and we do have some anecdotal evidence right now in 2025, almost 26, that, for example, civil engineers, mechanical engineers are actually doing better. That's a hotter field. They're getting hired out of school more than the computer scientists were, who were the hot field 10 or 20 years ago. So that's interesting to me, that I think there's going to be a bit of revenge of meat space versus this overhyped AI. So that's number one. Number two is to try to master the verbal end of things, written and spoken language. Because from what I can tell, America and perhaps Europe as well is radically becoming less and less literate. We are dumbing down our language. We are using emojis. We are becoming chimps with our little mobile phones. And if you can simply speak or write competently, if you are fluent in your own language, if you are well-spoken, if you have a good vocabulary, if you're a good public speaker, if you can write, I think that sets you apart by miles from your peers. Because I spent a lot of time in the big four world of the big accounting firms, which do a lot of merger and acquisition activity for private equity clients. The writing levels I saw in our reports, our missives to clients, were just abysmal. And so if you're articulate, you can seem smart, right? Being articulate adds some artificial IQ points in terms of your perception to the world around you. And that includes your romantic prospects. That includes your business prospects, your social prospects. And so I really encourage people to try to speak and write better. And that goes hand in hand, presumably, with thinking better. Which comes first, I'm not sure. They help each other. But I have sort of a stock speech I give at colleges and high schools sometimes, which is all about language and owning your words and thinking and speaking clearly. And it really makes a huge difference. You will really stand out in an interview if those things still exist.
This is something that I've thought about myself, because I see this in younger people, well, and in my own generation as well, that we're just not as well-spoken as our parents and grandparents were. It also goes to handwriting as well. I think that's quite well known that, you know, the handwriting used to be more ornate. It used to be more complex. Then it became more simple and babyish, and then it became a scrawl. And it's the same in speech. You said that you can make yourself seem smarter. I would say it's actually about you can also just make yourself seem as smart as you actually are. Because there are people who, because they're not articulate or well-spoken, actually seem less intelligent than they are. And I think that's a crime, to allow young people to disadvantage themselves artificially by entering the adult world, the working world, walking around giving themselves a bad rap because they've not learned how to speak. They'll mumble, they won't pronounce things correctly, and so forth. They'll use slang, all of that. The endless use of the word like. These are staples of millennial speech, unfortunately. I think this is crucial. And again, our grandparents simply wouldn't have needed to be told this. It would be absolutely obvious, especially in the professional worlds. If you want to get anywhere, you have to present well. And one of the first things that people notice about you is how you speak. How you dress obviously makes an impression as well. I mean, and that can go either way. But how you speak is crucially important.
Well, in a sense, if you can't say it or write it, you don't really know it. And
yes,
I think if enterprise and college professors wanted to stop worrying about AI, they could simply tell their students, listen, throughout the semester, we're going to present material. You can use AI to your heart's content to synthesize it all, to learn it, to categorize it, to organize it, to bullet point it, whatever you want to do. But the tests are going to be oral, right? To see what actually got into your brain and can come out of your mouth. They would never have to worry about AI again as a professor. I'm sure they would be fired from their universities if they actually attempted to do that. But that's what I would attempt to do.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a bit about AI, and then we'll get to UBI. So we'll get back into the economics thing after this. AI, everyone's talking about it now. It's been mentioned in many of this year's millennial streams. You said earlier that it's been overhyped, and I guess you think it's going to be a repeat of the dot-com bubble. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I would say it is meaningful in that it will have the kind of impact on our lives that moving online had, and the kind of impact on our lives that the emergence of complex software had. I think it's basically the next evolution in the digital revolution. But I do think it's overhyped in that a lot of bullshit money is being funneled into this now. A lot of that will be wasted. A lot of those companies will fail and investors will lose their shirts. And, a few will come out of it. And let's not, those of us who are old enough to recall the 90s will remember there were a bunch of companies that didn't make it. And now we just think of Amazon or Google or Apple. They're almost like furniture. They're almost like the landscape. They're just part of us. But it wasn't always clear that they were going to be part of us, that it wasn't going to be Alta Vista or something, And so.
Ask Jeeves, Lycos.
Ask Jeeves. Oh my God. And that little paperclip thing that would come out.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I was there.
I mean, a lot of people hated graphical interfaces. The whole idea of Apple was going to have these little smiley looking boxes was considered offensive to the techie guys who wanted to code everything and prompt with, coded prompts. So we never know. And there'll probably be some big winners that emerge from all this. But I mean, honestly, there's a lot of hype about this in legal circles because people say, well, what's a lawyer going to do? Because you can just synthesize a legal argument and you can do this and that. So far, there have been some lawyers who have actually been sanctioned for presenting legal briefs in a courtroom setting that were literally made up by AI. They were cases that didn't exist that just perfectly fit what they wanted to say or argue. And so those lawyers didn't bother to go find out that the case didn't exist. They just accepted what AI gave them. And the opposing counsel went to look up the case and said, wait a minute, this isn't real, and told the judge. And they got hopefully more than just chewed out. I would hope they would get badly sanctioned. But when I read about there's a lot of intellectual synthesis, you could put the entire U.S. tax code, for example, into AI and suss out certain things. It might get it right. It might not. But it just struck me that in some of these articles I've read about how AI created a really solid legal brief, a human had to judge that it was a really solid legal brief, right? It wasn't AI saying, oh, yes, this is great. It was a human judging that. So I'm not sure how far and how fast this goes, but I think I'm just naturally reflexively anti-hype. And so maybe that's my blind spot here.
Well, people say that it will revolutionize all sorts of areas of work, ordinary everyday tasks, budgeting and all that. I don't know. I think it probably already is. I think it probably already is doing that. And so the question is, how far will it go? Where does it end? It's only just started. That's the other thing. It's easy to forget that 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we didn't have ChatGPT. We weren't talking about this. And already it seems to be revolutionizing the workplace. So I take the point that it might end up being underwhelming. But right now, it already seems to be...
Let's just say it'll change our lives. Will it improve our lives? Again, let's go back to, let's say, our great-grandparents. They had to type on paper. And if they made a mistake, someone had to cross it out with a little whiteout and retype it. They didn't have email. They didn't have cell phones. They didn't have text. They didn't have PowerPoint, Microsoft Word, all these tools that we use for granted. Now, in a very real sense, these tools are wonderful and they make us more productive. Are we more productive per hour than our grandparents? I'm not so sure about that. So again, these things will change our lives. I'm not sure that they will improve them. In other words, is everybody just working 20 hours a week now because of all these tools? No. And so when AI comes along, will everyone just be working 10 hours a week because, oh my gosh, AI now is going to go make our breakfast for us? No, I think the answer is no. We see this time and time again. Human beings want more. There's one thing we know about these irascible, spiteful, irrational humans is they always want more. And so if you were to transport someone to the West today from 1500 magically, they would probably look around and say, oh my gosh, you guys solve scarcity. Everybody here is overweight. They have so many calories, they're overweight. There's this hot and cold running water magically comes out here. I press this magic button on the wall and these things called lights come on. I get in this thing on wheels called a car and it drives me around. I get in this thing called an airplane and it goes 600 miles an hour through the air. You know, they would basically say that you guys have solved scarcity. And yet, do we have poor people today? Are we all blissfully happy today just in our material wealth? No, of course, because it always goes back to that broader sense of purpose in life and what are we really doing. So I think AI, I guess my irritation with AI is the kind of people who champion it are the kind of people I don't like. They create a religion out of it. These really sick types. I really loathe public intellectuals. I hate them with a purple passion, if you know that expression. Yes. When someone brings up someone like a Steven Pinker, I just want to take a baseball bat through a plate glass window that anyone on earth listens to a charlatan like that. Now, he might well be smart. I don't give a crap about that. But it's his ilk tends to get interviewed about things like AI or that crazy Alex Karp guy at Palantir.
Yeah, sinister.
Yeah, very, very sinister. And so I don't like these people. And I don't want their vision of the future. I want AI to serve us, not the other way around. And so it's not my skepticism is in maybe in that sense combined with a distaste for this technocratic mindset that technology is going to save us. You know, that it'll outpace whatever human needs or desires we have. And so I don't really buy that. I don't think technology is a religion. And people who do tend to be, I think, very anti-human in their outlook. And so I don't like that.
Yeah, I completely agree. It was the same a few years ago with Klaus Schwab and his Yuval Noah Harari. And I thought, these people, I wouldn't want to go for a drink with these two guys. Or Bill Gates. Any of the people involved in the whole COVID thing. They just seem inhuman and sinister and not well-intentioned and not real people. It's weird. They seem weird. I would say the same about Jeff Bezos. Although he's a bit different, so and Alex Karp now, who's in charge of Palantir, again, same thing. Just I don't trust these people. I don't trust their intentions. I mean, I don't know what you think about climate change, but I always had the same inkling about people who were pushing that. I thought, I just don't trust you.
Yes. Yeah. And they've been forced to back away from that. It's not the political issue du jour anymore, because it didn't sell. It didn't sell well.
Yeah.
And one of the happy fallouts from that, it's a very quiet one, but some of these big car manufacturers have radically backed off their crazy claims that by 2030, let's say, the entirety of their fleet was going to be automatic. I mean, electric. You know, we're talking about Porsche. I want to say Audi. Certainly Volvo was saying this, and even the U.S. manufacturers, Ford has backed away. The Ford F-150 is a huge cultural phenomenon in America. It's very, very ubiquitous. See it everywhere. And the electric ones are complete crap, and nobody likes them. And so they've backed off that. So the good old-fashioned internal combustion engine may be with us a few years longer than planned, and I'm all for that.
Yeah, definitely. To get on to UBI, which is very much linked with everything that we've just mentioned, a few years ago was the whole COVID thing and the World Economic Forum, and they were using COVID, and I don't know how different it was in America, but in Europe it was definitely like this. They were using COVID as a springboard to launch a great reset. I think they said the fourth industrial revolution. I can't remember what the term was. And they were talking about this stuff that basically you'll own nothing and be happy. That was a phrase that was used in a hypothetical speculative paper. It wasn't actually an official catchphrase slogan, but it was there and people really latched onto it because they sensed that even if it wasn't an official phrase, it did sum up their mentality and what they wanted for us to own nothing and be happy. And they talked about the 20-minute cities and so forth. And underlying all of this seemed to be that there isn't going to be much room for, money-making, capitalism, business as we have always known it. Basically, it's a sort of communist utopia. And so, therefore, UBI, Universal Basic Income, would have to be a key part of it. Now, that utopia stuff has sort of fallen by the wayside since 2021 for various reasons. But they still seem to be talking about it now and then. But also, it just feels as if the economy is changing in such a way that it's going to rear its head again. I guess it depends on whether we have a massive recession, but then this might be presented as the solution to that. It's a weird thing where you could see it coming from extreme prosperity or from extreme economic upheaval. Either way, they could start pushing UBI. What would you say about all of that?
It's true. I think UBI will return in maybe a different form. But let's go back and recall that a lot of people liked COVID. A lot of people liked staying home. A lot of people liked shrinking from life. Retreatism, call it what you will. A lot of people thoroughly enjoy that. And they tended to be the people who still got their paycheck, by the way, while home in their jammies. And we can call them that. I used this term earlier, the laptop class. Ditch diggers don't get paid while they're home. The building trades people don't get paid while they're home. Waiters and waitresses don't get paid. But the laptop class stayed home and got paid. And the idea that you shrink from purpose even in life, and that you do so gladly, and that you're very happy to have this at least reprieve from the fray of your life, is not positive. That shows a lack of optimism, a lack of drive, lack of hopefulness, a lot of things that, if anything, America used to be known for, And there really is in America, again, I'll speak to the situation I know best. In America, there already is kind of UBI. You can get quite a bit in what we call SNAP benefits, which are a form of food stamps, they used to be called. And those represent hidden breadlines. In the Great Depression, in this country and in Europe, you had literal breadlines and soup lines. Well, we still have those. They haven't gone away. They're just hidden now because people have some sort of electronic card they use at the grocery store, and it doesn't seem any different than anyone else in line paying. So you can get quite a bit of support, even in America, which a lot of Europeans view as this really dystopian dog-eat-dog capitalist economy where you can be thrown out of your job or thrown out of your apartment and there's hardly any unemployment insurance and all this and that. It's not as much as Europe, but it's very much there. So we have a UBI of sorts. And of course, the great folly of this is we can certainly put on our economist hat and say, if you created some new baseline in the United States of UBI, just say, oh my gosh, this country's so big and so rich that we can just stroke even the least, the lowest income people or people who don't work at all, we can stroke them all enough so that everybody makes a minimum of $40,000 a year, let's say, in the US. Well, prices would adjust and they would adjust quickly because even though you're giving people more money, there's not magically all of a sudden more goods and services to buy. There's not magically all of a sudden more apartments to rent or more cars to finance or anything else. So you give people a bunch more money who didn't have it before and they go out and try to buy things. Well, those things they try to buy will immediately go up in price. I mean, this is not rocket science. So that strikes me as a bit silly. And we also need to remember that America is in a unique position because of the U.S. dollar and because of its status as the world's reserve currency. In my opinion, that has meant that we can export a lot of our pain in the form of inflation, and that when our Congress spends way more than it takes in tax revenues, it can basically monetize that debt and using a little bit of a roundabout process whereby that our U.S. Fed acts as the backstop for issuing new treasury debt in case the markets out there across the world don't want it so much at that rate of interest. They'll with a wink and a nod, the Fed will buy it. And then, of course, there's the fiscal side too. And this occurred very, very much in Europe, but during COVID in the U.S. between the Biden administration and then later the Trump administration, on the fiscal side, this had nothing to do with monetary policy. They simply created, Congress simply passed a bill that says, hey guys, print up about $6 trillion. And that was cash. That wasn't bank reserves or any of the kind of Byzantine plumbing that we talk about with monetary policy. That was straight cash into the hands of individuals in the form of checks and also to businesses. And that money was in checking accounts and being spent. So that was you know, real money. So that causes a lot of inflation because, again, there's no new goods or services when you print up that $6 trillion. And but we don't feel it nearly as much as we would if we were Argentina or if we were Zimbabwe or even if we were the UK with our pound, right? Because we're able to spread those dollars across the world. There's a lot of demand for treasury debt across the world by central banks, by government treasuries, by all kinds of pension and investment funds, which are actually required to hold a certain amount of their holdings in treasuries, considered a very safe asset. And so we can spread that $6 trillion around the world a little bit in a way that a smaller country without the world's reserve currency could not. So in that, because of that distortion, I would argue that UBI sort of looks more doable. You say, well, gee whiz, you know, we've had all these instances, Jeff, where the government just went crazy and bailed people out and printed a bunch of money. We had the 08 crisis, and then we had COVID, and the sky didn't fall. And yeah, there's a little more inflation, but there wasn't hyperinflation. And so why can't we just give everybody a check? And maybe we can. Maybe we can do that a lot longer than I think we can. But apart from the economics, there's what that does to the human soul and the human psyche. And it's nothing good. And so that's a whole different question.
Yeah, but also a crucial question, because even if this were economically feasible, and I don't know whether it is or not, I think it would do enormous damage. I mean, to ordinary people. Now, if everyone were an aristocrat and they're very self-sufficient, they know about everything, they've got a lot of agency, and they're interested in 100 different things and so on, like the Ubermensch, then this would be okay. This would be harmless. It would be a sensible, common sense solution. It just everyone has a sort of bedrock, a financial bedrock. But the reality is, you know, given human nature as it actually is, that millions and millions of people would just fall into despair and despondency, because they would have nothing to do, because they wouldn't need to do anything. I mean, remember the communist dream that people will be a poet in the morning and a composer in the afternoon and an architect in the evening. I mean, in the real world, with the human material as it actually is, that will never, ever happen.
Could you imagine the average person's poetry? Ugh. I mean, absolutely preposterous.
Yeah, yeah. Of course. Of course it is. So what would actually happen is just, I think people would fall apart and they would just become addicted to anything, like drugs, porn, gambling. I don't know. But they would need something to do. Because, I mean, there is a minority of guys who aren't driven, aren't motivated. They're happy to just, you know, lounge around. And that's, you know, there are guys like that, and they're kind of refreshing to meet now and then. But most guys aren't like that. They need a purpose in life. Certainly most white guys. I remember once saying this to an Indian guy, and he said that he thought I was wrong, that most guys don't need purpose. well, maybe that's Indian guys. Maybe they can do without it. But I'm convinced that most white guys really need to know where their life is going and what they're for, and to have a goal and so forth, whether it's a role and a goal, both of those things. So UBI would undermine that fatally. So this is really the danger with it, I think.
Absolutely. And it also creates a dependent population, which is a nice thing for political reasons. And it creates a despondent population, which is easier to lead around by the nose. There's no question about it. It's a more, it's a placated foe. You know, you can tell, you mentioned Yuval Harari. Is that his name? Havari?
Yes, Yuval Noah Harari. Yeah,
the WEF guy. I mean, he views humans as this sort of irritating thing he has to deal with. You know, that if we could just get rid of these pesky Neanderthals and their base, you know, day-to-day lives, then, you know, we could get on with it. That's the sense you get from that guy. And so maybe if you just gave everyone Soma, in effect, and stuck them at home, and let the Yuval Hararis of the world have free reign, it'd be a lot easier than having these uprisings like Brexit or Trump.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. He seems to see humanity as a sort of infestation that just needs to be mollified and thinned out and got
culled,
rid of, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Culled. In order that real progress can happen. And from his point of view, that probably does make sense, because you don't need that many programmers to maintain the AI. So what do we need people for? Obviously, you come to the conclusion that, well, this is a crazy world they're building if it's one that doesn't need humans.
Well, it certainly doesn't require wombs. We know that.
Yes, yes. And the thing that he said was that people would, because I think it was put to him, well, what will ordinary people do in this world, in this future? And he said, I think he said porn, video games, and drugs. I think it was that. Yeah. And again, to talk about your average guy, he would have a lot. Your average guy would have a lot of fun with an abundance of porn, video games, and drugs, but eventually he'd go mad with the lack of purpose, I think. Maybe I'm speaking about myself, but these things are luxuries, and you can have fun with them, but it's going to result in disaster, really personal disaster, if you don't have a purpose. So this is the worry, I think, and also the worry is that these guys like Noah Harari and Klaus Schwab don't seem to be taking this into account. But again, it's possible that the technological advance just makes it impractical to take account of these things, because they're thinking about what's the most efficient way to do life on Earth. And it might be that the most efficient way is with huge amounts of automation, AI, and a few programmers to deal with, to keep that going. And everyone else is basically redundant. So if that is the most efficient way, then as a technocrat, that's what you're going to go for.
Yes, you need a cadre of, let's say, over 130 or 140 IQ people, and the rest you can just kind of warehouse. That seems a very unpleasant place to live, but I don't know. I think we're going to have the kind of technological change in the 21st century that at least rivals that of the 20th. And the 20th century is a century not of liberal triumph. The 20th century is an illiberal disaster, in my view. And so the idea that we can get through vast sociological changes driven by technology as the leader without a heck of a lot of friction and maybe even bloodshed on the back end, I'm not so sure.
Yeah. And that is a perspective that when you look at the 20th century and you look at the 21st, where is all of this heading? Self-sufficiency for individuals was not a priority of the 20th century. and in the 21st century, everything is getting even more centralized and streamlined by, if not governments, then by corporations. I mean, and investment firms like BlackRock, who can just buy up massive tracts of land and then operate it in, again, the most efficient way. And presumably that because the Woodlander was talking about this, that they're trying to make it difficult to be a farmer in Britain. And presumably this is the reason that they've come up with some plan that, well, the farming will be done in this area, this country, this zone. And so the other countries just don't need to be doing that. So all of the farmers there are just screwed. Again, you can understand it from their point of view as technocrats. If that is the most efficient way, then that's what they'll go for. And I don't know, there's no sort of conclusion to this, except that something's going to have to give, because I just don't think this future is amenable to humanity as it actually is. I don't think it's a pro-human future that seems to be getting designed here.
Yes, and it feels very planned. It doesn't feel spontaneous. It doesn't feel chosen. It definitely feels planned, that there are self-designated overlords and that they have decided that we need, among other things, we need fewer people on Earth. And among other things, farming is this dirty, polluting, labor-intensive business. We ought to push that to certain places. And we don't need family farmers or small farms. We need to do that in an efficient corporate manner. And these rural people are just going to have to learn to do something else. Or they can sit at home with the aforementioned UBI. But at any rate, we need to change rural America into something radically different. And village life in the United Kingdom is also, I think, under attack. That needs to be changed into something radically different.
Yeah.
And, the libertarian purist sees no market again for continuity. he sees no human marketplace for maintaining certain traditions that people happen to like, maintaining certain ways of life that people happen to like, even if they are not the most economically advantageous forms of life, right? Having a pub in your town that's still vital and that is not owned by some chain somewhere is not something you can just measure easily. It's not something you can put into GDP, but it has a material benefit to the community as a meeting place and as a place where camaraderie is created and where people get to know each other, and it connects people, let's say, in a who live near the pub. It almost gives them a second living room outside of their house or their flat.
Oh yeah.
And so how do you just say, well, you know, these pubs are dying out and we, you know, people don't really want them, and let's put in a wine bar and some nachos to go along with the fish and chips, because, you know, we got to give people what they want. And then, you know, let's put on some American football too, because they're starting to play a game every year in London. And this, you know, so that kind of thing, I think, is the tail wagging the dog. The purist libertarians say, well, that's the marketplace, Jeff. And I don't think it is. I think it's something imposed rather than chosen. And so we do have a human desire for place and for continuity and for stability and tradition. And there is something very unsettling in to basic human nature about constant upheavals. And we should have fewer of those. Yes. And that's considered an anti-market viewpoint.
Well, let's talk about libertarianism briefly, and I'll ask you why. I mean, it sounds like you've sort of moved away from it, at least in a qualified sense. What do you think are the weaknesses of when the rubber hits the road? Not in theory, but when the rubber hits the road, what are the weaknesses of libertarianism?
Well, I think first and foremost, I suppose I am a libertarian in this sense. I don't necessarily think that we need what we call a government or an organized state to perform the functions of police and courts and so-called national defense. And I do, in a sense, think that those could be performed privately. But that's a little different than the core philosophical arguments behind libertarianism, the starting point of which is individualism, which is just bunk. It's bad praxeology. It's not how humans work. Humans are collaborative, collective animals. That's how they survived through some very difficult prehistorical times. And that's how they continue to survive, how they continue to relate to one another. And even economists who want to use the individual as the unit of analysis in economics, we talk about real economics is almost home economics. That's how Socrates saw it. But we don't just study the so-called Robinson Crusoe model of a person alone on the island and economizing in the sense that that person has to choose, should I go fish today, or should I work on building my hut today, or should I work on getting a fire started today? You know, those are the choices. That's the economy. I've got the whatever capital assets available to me on this Robinson Crusoe Island. No, we tend to instead worry about macroeconomics, which is, from what I can tell, one step removed from astrology. And, you know, the global macroeconomics, currencies, countries, international trade, all that kind of thing, which is, you know, very hellishly complex, because nobody really knows what 8 billion people are going to get up and do tomorrow. It's awfully hard to predict. And so the idea of individualism, that the individual ought to be the measure of everything, I think it does not comport with human nature. And while I certainly want individuals to have rights, and I do think it's all fine and good for government to focus on protecting those rights, you know, that human beings do not, as social creatures, which is to say economic actors, do not operate as individuals. So, the idea that we should, you know, focus everything politically or governmentally on the individual is a bit of an odd way to start things. It's a bit of an ahistorical way to start things. Number two is the libertarian mindset wants to view, in the Murray Rothbard sense, harm to others as the only reason that government can ever step in. In other words, everyone has a right to self-defense and they can sort of outsource that to the government. But the only thing government ought to do is prevent people from engaging in actual literal force or fraud to their person. Everything else, you know, is not about protecting rights anymore. And it should just be anything goes beyond that. So if someone with, you know, 10 million Twitter followers calls you a pedophile to his 10 million listeners or followers, I should say, and as a result of that, you're utterly ruined. You lose your job, you lose your family, you lose your friends, you're cast out of decent society. Well, the purest libertarian perspective says, well, you know, you can argue your own case about why you're not a pedophile. You know, talk about when you're explaining you're losing. You can go out and issue your own tweet, you know, but what you can't do is sue the guy for saying that, even though it's untrue, because that's not the proper role of government. You don't have a right to your reputation or your job or your income or your family relationships. These are all voluntary things. You know, you don't have a right to other people's thoughts, opinions, feelings, attitudes towards you. And so if you lose all those things as a result of this guy's tweet, that's just not an actionable item in libertarian land. And I disagree with that. I think we have to view harm to society, the kind of thing for which the government or whatever collective enforcement authority has to step in. I think we have to view it more broadly. I mean, John Stuart Mill had this way back when. His very simple principle was that, you know, you can never interfere with a man's freedom simply because he's hurting himself. Harm to himself is not enough. It has to be harm to, okay. All right, well, you know, maybe I can buy that to an extent. If some guy wants to stay home and ruin his life with drugs, I don't particularly care to have the police kick his door down and club him over the head and drag him off to prison. Okay, fine. However, that guy is hurting other people. He is hurting other people. He's hurting his parents. He's hurting his ancestors who struggled awfully hard to make it so that someday he popped out on this earth. And by golly, this is not libertarian, but I think he owes them something. And by golly, if he's got kids or is thinking about them, or even if it's just a societal thing, I think he owes the future something, which is to get up there and do his best to kick drugs and make something of his life where he is of at least some service to others, or at least no burden on them, which a junkie is almost certainly going to become a burden on the medical system or the prison system, whatever it might be. And so the idea, the central core idea of libertarianism is that you have a right to do anything you want so long as you're not harming others. Okay, deep breath, step back. Well, first of all, when has that ever been the case in human history? That's an absurdly broad statement. Absurdly broad statement that needs a hell of a lot of support for it. Since when have you been able to do whatever you want as long as it doesn't hurt anyone else? Okay. That's very, very broad. Second of all, is the idea that flows from that is that consent is everything. Consent is the linchpin of a free society. Now, we express our consent to government through democratic mechanisms. Absolute nonsense, of course. Voting is an illusory right. It's absolute nonsense. We get an exceedingly narrow range of choices of whom to vote for. We have no idea who actually wins because we're not involved in the voting apparatus. And so the idea that voting somehow represents our consent of the governed is just absolutely preposterous. And that's just an infantile thing. I mean, when a grown adult actually sort of mumbles something along those lines, you can pretty safely dismiss them. And their thinking. I mean, that's the second grade stuff. But in the more interpersonal sense of things, that consent is the linchpin. There was a very famous libertarian organization, an early one, started in the 40s, called the Foundation for Economic Education, known famously as FEE. And that was started by a gentleman named Leonard Reed, who sort of came from a background in boosterism, this sort of chamber of commerce kind of guy. But very, very smart, a very brilliant guy. And he marshaled a lot of resources. He went with some famous, involved with some very famous people like Henry Hazlitt and Ludwig von Mises. And he set up this educational foundation. And as much as we talk about capitalism and markets today, let's not forget in the 40s, 50s, mid-century in Europe and America, socialism and communism were considered inevitable. They were considered technically correct, that the Soviet Union was going to outpace the West in its output, and that socialism was scientific. You know, so it's easy to talk for the, you know, the Catos, and you have in the UK, you have things like Adam Smith, you have the Cobden Center, the similar kind of think tanks that are pro-capitalism. That's easy today compared to the early and mid 20th century. I mean, it's a far easier day. We're far more capitalist in our mindset today. But nonetheless, Leonard Reed came along and was doing this yeoman's work. And I think he was a good guy and all that. But he came up with this preposterous slogan called Anything Peaceful. And so what he meant by that is the government should never interfere in peaceful interactions between human beings. It's only, again, when they go out and harm one another. And harm, defined again very, very narrowly, is an actual punch to the face or stealing of the car, you know, not in any broader sense. And anything peaceful. And if you think about that, I mean, what that permits is, we mentioned the guy on UBI, sitting at home, porn, smoking pot, video games, right? That's peaceful. He's not hurting anyone, right? Well, okay, but I no longer buy that. I was a very annoying ANCAP, as they say, an anarcho-capitalist throughout my 20s, 30s. And I would have argued with a straight face that, you know, a traffic cop in a bad mood or a DMV clerk, they're the state, and they can ruin your life, you know, by denying you that new tag for your car, pulling you over and giving you a speeding ticket. But your relationship with them is involuntary. They have guns and they can put you in jail if you don't go along with it. But your relationship with Google or Twitter or Goldman Sachs or your mortgage company, that's voluntary. You don't have to do that. So that's totally different. And so they're not evil, and that traffic cop or DMV clerk is. And it's like, okay, that's exceedingly facile, right? Corporations yes. are deeply enmeshed with the state at every level, and they wield enormous power over our lives. And that's why Twitter was kicking people off who were asking questions about COVID shots, for example. So, you know, I think that facile black and white thinking is a bad idea. And so
just hold that thought. Hold that thought.
Too much.
Another thing is that corporations are not just in league with the government and the state, but also that they have a tremendous amount of power themselves, because they're often they often have a monopoly. So they have a cap. You see, in order to use that service that everyone else is using, or in order to use that product that you'd really need to use, you have to accept the terms and conditions. So it's voluntary, but not really. And you know, 2 years ago, I wrote an essay about the film RoboCop. And I say that there's a line of dialogue in that film which makes the whole film possible. And the line of dialogue is, so a cop gets killed in the line of duty and they convert him into a cyborg. And the line of dialogue is, well, he signed the release forms when he joined the force. He's legally dead. We can do pretty much whatever we want to him.
Yeah.
That's the thing. In order to get the job as a cop, he had to sign these forms. So then there's no recourse. You know, they've obtained his consent. This is the whole thing about the consent being everything. They've obtained his consent, so they can go ahead and do whatever they want.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a very left-wing argument that consent in a harsh capitalist system is under duress, you know, and so I don't entirely buy that, but it's just interesting that the idea that consent is the linchpin and the measurement of a free or decent society. And I just don't think that's correct. I don't think that's enough. Anything peaceful is not enough. We need people to get up and do all the million little things that every day that bolster society and creates opportunities for other people. And economists, market economists of all people, should understand that the market is supposed to be social cooperation. It's supposed to be complementary. It's not supposed to be this atomized, individualistic thing. And so I think libertarianism went badly astray.
Yeah, I've got an amusing meme that makes this point. apparently, it is actually based on a real quote. I mean, this is obviously insane in the real world. You cannot have something like this. But according to pure libertarian precepts, this you would have to approve of it. You know, parents selling their kids to each other. I mean, that's obviously mental. I'm going to make sure whether that is a real quote or not, because it's so preposterous. But let me just—I'm obviously making the point that.
So this
well, apparently,
is
yes. apparently actually is a real quote. Bloody hell!
So I know Rothbard's work well. You had brought up monopoly earlier. He has a very famous section in his main economics treatise, which is called Man, Economy, and State, which attacks monopoly theory in root and branch, and basically says monopolies exist because of state power and state favoritism. The idea of a natural monopoly, which is accepted even by a lot of free market economists, is incorrect. And I would lead people to, there are libertarians who kind of disagree, and there are libertarians who certainly agree with Rothbard on monopoly. He took it farther than his predecessor Mises. So as he gets into the 70s and 80s, Rothbard starts writing a lot more about what we would call libertarianism or political theory. He gets away from just pure economics. He writes this book that you have the quote up here in question, The Ethics of Liberty, comes out in 1974. For a New Liberty comes out in 1974, and he expands upon this. This is about the early 80s here, The Ethics of Liberty. You might be interested to know that this book from which you're quoting was at least in part funded by the Kochs so that Murray Rothbard could have the time to write it. I actually met Rothbard. He died in the mid-90s, around 95. I met him in 1992. When he was teaching at UNLV in Las Vegas in the United States. And so he was a bomb thrower. He was a radical, to be sure. And he wanted to take markets as far as they could go. And he came up with some, you know, the quote you have here. He came up also with some stuff about abortion that would certainly radically turn off anyone who is pro-life. And so I think you have to view that in the context of he was trying to be an uber advocate of the most radical system, human freedom, however defined, that you could come up with, and that he was sort of intentionally trying to think of a lifeboat situation or taking everything to the nth degree. And so, yes, I absolutely disagree with the idea of a free market children. I think that's abhorrent. I also, though, know enough about Rothbard, who is absolutely prodigious, wrote millions and millions and millions of words, many, many books, innumerable articles. I also know enough about him to sort of view that in the context of everything else he wrote. So he was definitely the person who took anarcho-capitalism to its furthest reaches. And once you accept a lot of libertarian doctrine, it's hard to then turn around and find a logical refutation to what Rothbard says there about selling kids, right? That's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
In other words, some things are just plain crazy and we don't need to refute them. They should just be dismissed.
Yeah, 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 exactly. There are some things that you can't especially once you've accepted certain precepts, you can't logically argue against, but you know instinctively are wrong. And so it's sort of a waste of time to argue against them. You just accept that, we're not going that far.
And so, the Randians, the objectivists would say, hold on, guys, contradictions don't exist. So if the conclusion you reach based on your principles, in this instance, selling kids is okay, then, and you don't like that conclusion, gee, that seems wrong. Well, then you have to go back and check your premises. And if you simply work through deductive or logical premises, you will find the faulty reasoning somewhere in that chain. But really, when it comes to a kid, a human life created involuntarily, by the way, by two people, the kid didn't ask for it. And that kid pops out hopeless, helpless against the cold, the wind, needs mom immediately, needs shelter immediately, needs a blanket immediately, needs sustenance immediately. And, you know, it's awfully hard to say, well, the child is unowned and he's nobody's property and he has X, Y, and Z rights. And, you know, you start to get into these just absolutely silly things when we know that what we really want is not to argue about libertarian ethics and crazy what-if scenarios. What we really want is to create a halfway decent culture where people take care of a baby, for God's sake.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, we'll get to the super chats now. Interesting conversation. Okay, this is from Scott, and he says, Jeff, the founders held that liberty is not based on a written document, but on the pre-existing values that the document embodies. If liberty is a cultural value, then shouldn't libertarians dedicate themselves to the preservation of cultures where these values are observed?
Yes.
Yeah. Short answer.
My answer is yes. And that, you know, refusing to fight the culture wars, this is another terrible libertarian blind spot. And the libertarian, what we can call Libertarian Inc. at places like Cato and Reason Magazine are just horrible on this. They view any pushback as push, right? There's a difference in the culture wars. When people try to impose Drag Queen Story Hour, and some other people say, well, wait a minute, I don't really think I want that for my kid. What are you fighting, a culture war? Right? No. Pushback isn't push. And by abdicating in the culture wars, which libertarians did, by the way, because they agreed with all the cultural victories of the left. That's the dirty little secret. Not that they were above the culture wars, but they agreed and they liked it. That's why libertarians say don't fight the culture wars. They approve of the way culture's going, and they hate Christian conservatives, for example. Hate them. That's absolutely the case. So, yes, by abdicating from the culture wars, guess what's downstream of culture? Everything. You end up with a very illiberal, nasty society when you abdicate in the culture wars.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're seeing this now, that it's the culture that holds everything together, and it's the people and heritage that holds together the culture. When you change that, you inevitably end up in a sort of no man's land. Okay, the Wanderer said, please ask Jeff to explain his handsome white stallion. Is it the heraldry of Kent or Hanover? And then he says some Latin that I will mispronounce if I try to read it out, but it's like Suscipier et Finir Wunderbar.
Well, so I have ancestry near Hanover. There are some, I guess we can call them mountains, to be fair. They're really hills, the Deister Mountains. And so some of my ancestors who came to America in the 1880s hail from that region. And of course, Hanover has a really interesting history. It was ultimately, towards the end, a kingdom only for a short period after 1814, Congress of Vienna and all that. And it actually had an absentee king, a British king, ruling over it, who'd actually never visited. But nonetheless, I've in recent years gotten a little bit into ancestry and learning about all the, you know, the incredible fiefdoms and principalities and dukedoms and all these things that made up what we presently call Germany, and the vast differences between, let's say, a Prussian and a Bavarian. And so I've just adopted in a bit of a tongue-in-cheek manner the flag of Hanover, because I have familial roots there.
All right. Oh, and I should say that the Woodlander, the Woodlander doesn't have a Labrador. It's a Pyrenees. There were some people wondering about that. Pyrenees.
I caught just glimpses of him petting it, and then I thought it was a British lab or an English lab.
A great Pyrenees called Eva. But anyway, all right. And then Scott C. also said, Jeff, I've always thought the Austrian business cycle theory was similar to the too big to fail doctrine, in that both propose regulating banks, albeit in different ways, to prevent an economic crash. Austrians wish to ban fractional reserve banking to prevent crashes.
Okay.
I don't know if you have anything to say about that.
Well, yeah, too big to fail. I mean, banks ought to be regulated in one way, one main way, which is they go out of business when they make bad loans, and that their shareholders, you know, go to zero, and that their account holders have to take whatever percentage on the dollar remains in the bank's assets. That would be the ideal way to see banks regulated. This never happens. Iceland kind of did that after their 2008 crisis, to their great credit. They let a bunch of German banks take a nasty haircut, and they let their own kroner — they weren't tied to the euro or they would have been sunk — they let their own Icelandic kroner float against all the various currencies, which meant that their unemployment did not — it spiked, but it didn't spike as high as it would. And by letting, by arresting some people, by firing some boards, putting some bankers in jail, they had a very, very severe but a short-lived 1 or 2 year rough time, and they came out of it far stronger. And this is what should have been allowed to happen at far greater scale in the United States during the global financial crisis of 2008. All of those banks should have been allowed to fail. And the bad debt should have been cleared out and repriced, and new owners should have come in and purchased those debts at obviously quite a discount. And we could have started over with a much healthier economy in America and beyond. Now, that you know, the extent to which fractional reserve banking plays into that is sort of a different question. And Austrians do oppose the idea of what we call fiduciary media, or creating loans wildly beyond the actual bank reserves or capital that they have to service those loans. So they do sort of disclose this when you go open an account at your bank branch. But the bottom line is that if everybody asks for their money all at once, the bank couldn't pay you. Just like that big corporate gym you go to, if everybody showed up on January 5th with all their weight loss, you know, New Year's Eve resolutions, then they'd go under. So it's an interesting question, but I do think the Austrian business cycle theory is broadly correct. It needs to be filled in some particulars, and there are scholars working on that. But I do think that low interest rates cause what we can call malinvestment. That causes a lot of projects to look good on paper that wouldn't look good otherwise, and that later on, when there's pressure on interest rates to rise, a lot of those projects get exposed as crazy, and a lot of people lose their shirts. And then governments step in and make sure that the fat cats don't lose their shirts, but that there's this sort of generalized pain felt across the economy. So, if anybody is interested in Austrian business cycle theory, there's a professor named Paul Swick, CWIK, in the US, who's written a really neat little monograph on it that's brief. I'm not going to give you some gigantic book to read. It's a very brief little, like, 60-page monograph. And if anybody wants to know how Iceland did it right, during the 2008, the global finance, the great financial crisis, the GFC, whatever we're calling it. Go read a book by Philip Bagus, B-A-G-U-S. He's a German working in Spain. He wrote a book on the Icelandic crisis, which is really fascinating.
All right. Okay, well, let's end it there. There was one last comment from the Wanderer when I think you were saying that economics isn't enough of a guide to build a blueprint for society. And he said, there's a reason the Scottish essayist Thomas Carlyle called economics the dismal science. Don't know if you'd have anything to say about that.
Carlyle is someone I've just started reading. And really, really fascinating. And I know he had coined that expression. And when we say economics isn't enough, it isn't everything, nor should it be. And that's very, very important to understand. And economists like Mises would be the first ones to admit that and tell you that. And there's something, I think, very transactional and very sick going on in our society, where we have decided that everything has to be short-term maximization and that there can't be any long-term benevolent viewpoint by wiser, older voices, let's say, in society. What is that? It starts to sound like a monarch. Well, nobody wants that. Monarchs are evil, right? Well, okay. But if you go read your Hoppe, you'll find out that maybe monarchs have a little bit more investment in what we call the cultural and material capital of a country. They want to pass that on to their own heirs and successors, for example, and that it's actually politicians in putatively democratic societies that have the incentive to just burn the future in order to promise a bunch of free stuff now and kick the can down the road. And by the time the troubles really come home to roost, they'll be dead and gone, but they'll have issued political patronage and maintained their own political status in the meantime. So this tedious Western impulse that monarchy bad, democracy good is definitely something that we need to revisit.
I couldn't agree more. And let's hope that happens in this century. That would be great.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's been great. So I've enjoyed this. I hope you have too.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I'll be back in 15 minutes with the next one. But in the meantime, Jeff Deist, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Get the info you need at millennial.com/crypto. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.